Hello and welcome to the Thursday, October 15th edition of Juno Afternoon on KTOO. We've got a great show. We're going to be talking to two authors, Jim Elliott and Jim King, and Nick Jantz, who brought our story of Romeo to the world. And then we're going to talk about Saturday's Health Forum at Centennial Hall, and Grace Elliott will be here, and also Nancy DeCharney for Arts Up. Stay tuned.
Reporting from the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention in Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton. Not in our smokehouse, protecting Alaska Native ways of life. That's what elders and youth from urban and rural areas across Alaska focused on during a three-day gathering that wrapped up Wednesday in Anchorage. The smokehouse is an important part of Native life, used as a way of preserving food. At this year's Elders and Youth Conference, hosted by the First Alaskans Institute, the smokehouse was used to represent the protection and love for bodies, minds, and souls. The conference was filled with physical activities for youth, opportunities to practice public speaking, training in Native languages, and discussions on difficult topics such as substance abuse and domestic violence. The Elders and Youth Conference is an annual event, which this year attracted more than 1,300 attendees. High-level state, federal, congressional, and White House leaders spoke to tribal leaders from across Alaska during a one-day conference held Wednesday in Anchorage. The Alaska Federation of Natives and the National Congress of American Indians hosted the get-together. Dozens of tribal attendees heard from U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, Governor Bill Walker, Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott, and several state commissioners, among other dignitaries. KNBA's Jocelyn Estes has this report.
Based in Washington, D.C., the National Congress of American Indians is made up of and advocates for the nation's 567 American Indian and Alaska Native tribes. NCAI Director Jackie Peta says she's attended many meetings of tribal leaders with U.S. presidents. She praised the meeting of Alaska Native tribal leaders with President Obama during his recent visit to Alaska.
Maybe I'm biased. I think this was the best meeting ever. The representatives that represented you in that meeting, that sit-down meeting with the president, were very succinct, had very clear direction, were organized and had different messages, and he was definitely impressed, and so was Secretary Jewell that was there with them, and I think it really helps us move the agenda, particularly for Alaska.
The president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, Julie Kitka, said AFN's planning with the White House began 6 months in advance of the visit. She says the ramifications of the visit, such as new money coming to Alaska Native tribes through dozens of programs, continue. Also, she says, the views of high-level officials were altered after seeing firsthand some of the issues Natives face. She urged tribal leaders to make the most of that during a White House tribal summit set for early November.
The president and his team is highly sensitive to what's going on in Alaska and highly sensitive to the doing things to help Alaska Natives and tribes on that is good for the state and good for the country. And so you actually have a very unique opportunity coming up very, very quickly.
Kitka described the state budget deficit as a crisis. She said AFN will need to work to ensure Alaska Natives and rural communities do not bear the brunt of state budget cuts. She also said tribal relations with the state of Alaska are vastly improved since the election of Governor Bill Walker and Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott.
We have a remarkable state government, a remarkable leadership with the governor and lieutenant governor in his cabinet. They have a mindset and an idea to try to solve problems and work together, which is incredibly, really good for the state and for Native people.
Other speakers gave reports and answered questions on a range of issues, such as state and federal budgets, drug interdiction, co-management of fish and game, as well as lands into trust. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
The 2015 annual AFN convention gets underway in Anchorage Thursday at the Denina Convention Center. Dignitaries set to address the crowds include Governor Bill Walker, Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott, U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan, and Congressman Don Young, as well as a White House representative. Work sessions on wellness, business, justice, and co-management of fish and game are planned. The theme for this year's AFN convention is Heroes in Our Homeland. Reporting from AFN, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The AFN newscast produced by Aquatic Broadcast Corporation and Native Voice One. Major funding provided by South Central Foundation, ConocoPhillips, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, Donnellan Gold, the Rasmussen Foundation, Shalista Corporation, the Siri Foundation, and Manaluk Association. Take the online listener survey found at knba.org. This is a production of KNBA Aquatic Broadcast Corporation and Native Voice One, the Native American radio service.
Hello and welcome to Juneau Afternoon on KTOO. It's 6 minutes past the hour. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show. He is at the board. I'm Joan Partis, your talking head for Thursdays, and the weather is such. It's raining outside, highs around 49. Tonight, rain likely. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, patchy fog in the morning, chance of rain. And Friday night and Saturday, rain, lows around 47. Right now, it is 47 downtown and at the airport, and 45 in the Mendenhall Valley, dropping to 39 in the valley tonight, and 40 and 42 at the airport and downtown. So, as I said when we started the show, we've got two authors. We've got Jim King. We've got Nick Jans in the waiting room. We've got Grace Elliott. We've got community events. We've got Arts Up. So we're going to go plunge right in. So our very first guest today is Jim King. He lives in Juneau. He's lived in Juneau for 50 years. We're here with his book called Attending Alaska's Birds, a Wildlife Pilot Story. And Jim Reardon, a wonderful Alaskan author who lives up in Homer, he wrote the foreword for this book, and I'm going to just read a little bit of it. Over the past half century, Jim King has probably been involved in more significant conservation actions than any other single Alaskan wildlife scientist. Many of the adventures he recounts in this volume are based on his participation in the selection of millions of acres of new wildlife refuges that came with the 1980 Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. His years of flying waterfowl counts had made him familiar with the state's most productive wildlife areas. We are talking about, in his tenure, 100 million seabirds, 70 million shorebirds, and 12 million waterfowls, over 6,000 hours of pilot hours. So welcome to the show, Jim King. How are you today?
Well, I'm good.
Good.
I'm here.
That is really great. So this book, it has maps and it has photos and it has 50 years of information, if not more. And do you want to talk a little bit about the journey of this book, or do you want to talk about your a specific section of the book?
Well, I thought I'd talk about the whole book. I as a wildlife biologist, we were taught that you should write up your work. And I did that, and I had over 50 publications of one sort or another about things I worked on. And when I retired, I thought, well, I'll stack those up and make a book out of them. But when I stacked them up and started working with them, and it didn't work. So I just need to start and do a memoir, and that's what I did. And let's see, I got 429 pages and 14 chapters, 135 references, and 25 pages of index, and 8 pages of an atlas that shows where 300 places that I talked about are. So, and I think I find that having an index is important, and people reading indexes, and I think that's something that people writing a memoir often don't do.
Well, with so much information, this is an index is actually essential. But let me read the introduction here. So the U.S. government, this is the first part of the book. I'm going to read the first part and the last part because it's really beautiful. So the U.S. government gave me the chance to pilot little airplanes all over the Northwest wilds, along with a mandate to report on the prosperity of many of our fellow creatures. This is Jim King talking, not me. Flying among Alaska's birds is what I did for over 50 years, logging more than 9,000 hours as a pilot or co-pilot. I focused on the birds, often at between 100 and 500 feet above ground, to try to determine what kinds there were, how many, what they were doing, and how they were faring, and what they might need from mankind. A number of ground studies enhanced my perspective. I had to give a good deal of thought to reporting effectively on what I was seeing. And then he goes into his career. It took him throughout Alaska over the 50 years, and obviously Alaska has changed dramatically in the past 50 years. You were here when it was a territory, is that correct?
Yeah. I started in 1950, so that was 9 years of still territory that I was roaming around.
So it seems like you kind of came into your own as Alaska came into its own as a biologist. And then in the end, Jim King writes, the ancient Alaska moral code from dog team days charges travelers to always leave a clean camp and a little dry firewood. My generation has left the camp a little messy and the wood a little damp, but we tried. I'm glad I was involved. The challenge for the next generation is to do a better job. I see the hopeful signs that they will. The world is watching. So this book was published a few years ago, correct?
2010.
So 5 years ago. So do you still have the same optimism that you had when you...
Oh, yeah. I think young people now are talking a lot more about environmental issues than kids my age did.
I'm sure.
We didn't even know what that word meant.
But then again, you live that, though. You're out there.
Yeah. And, well, conservation, you know, was starting to, after World War II is when it started to game departments were developing and state programs, and there was more emphasis on parks and refuges for animals. So I think the young people they're much more into backcountry and places like Juneau.
Exactly. And you've probably seen so many changes in Juneau itself over the years.
Well, you said I've seen a lot of changes, and that's true of the communities, the people. But, you know, I spent my career flying all around every year for a lot of hours, and the country hadn't changed much. You know, people are concerned about climate change, but climate's always been doing things, and the land is doing things. There's floods and volcanoes and earthquakes. So the big changes, though, are in the towns and the big towns. Although Juneau, I think there's at least twice as many people here as there were when we came here.
I would imagine.
So it's growing.
Yeah. Well, we're going to probably have to wrap up this section. Is there anything in closing that you want to talk about?
Well, really, one of the beauties of Alaska is that we haven't plowed it all up or logged it all off. It hasn't changed seriously. So, and people are facing the value of the way it is in a more realistic way than, you know, they used to talk about Alaska, the last frontier. Well, frontiers were where they tore up nature and built farms and cities. And
they made a grid.
Yeah, I think of Alaska as the first frontier for doing a better job of protecting the environment.
Oh, that's a wonderful sentiment, and really wonderful to hear. Well, thank you so much for your service for the state and for this book. It's called Attending Alaska's Birds, A Wildlife Pilot Story by James G. King, Jim King. The foreword's by Jim Reardon. It's got a lovely picture of mountains and mallards.
Those are swans.
Swans, okay, swans.
Trumpeter swans, and that's Douglas Island from my window at Sunny Point.
Oh, that is great. And there is a lovely section about trumpeter swans, which I did read while I was in here, because when I lived out in the valley, I used to see them all the time at Dredge Lakes. And so there's a lovely part about that. But if you want to read it, you're going to have to go buy it. So we're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back. Thank you so much for joining us today.
This is Bird Note. You may have noticed on a trip to the shore or a waterfront restaurant where gulls gather that many gulls have a bright red spot near the tip of their otherwise yellow bills. Behind that red spot lies a considerable tail. That's T-A-L-E. In the mid-20th century, Dutch scientist Nico Ten Bergen studied nesting herring gulls. He noticed that newly hatched gull chicks were fed by their parents only after they pecked at the adult's bills. Ten Bergen devised experiments that varied the shape and coloration of the adult's bill. It became clear that the red spot on the adult gull's bill was a crucial visual cue in a chick's demands to be fed, and thus its survival. Ten Bergen also made the case that the chick's attraction to the red spot on the bill was instinctive. This conclusion came at a time where there was a furious debate among experts about whether such behavior was learned or innate. Ten Bergen's gull research helped lay the groundwork for the science of animal behavior, and in 1973 earned him a Nobel Prize. And it all started with that little red spot. Learn more about Ten Bergen's research and see a photo of that red spot on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Oh, welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Joan Pardis, your Thursday host. Jeff Brown's the producer and engineer of the show. It is 17 after the hour, and our very next guest is Nick Jans. I'm very happy to be in the studio with him. Nick is an author, and he wrote a book called A Wolf Called Romeo about Juno's very own Romeo. And I'm not going to tell you what I thought about it. I'm going to tell you what the New York Times thought about it. Jans is an exceptional storyteller. No nature writer can top him in terms of sheer emotional force, and he frames even the smallest moment with haunting power. Haunting power. That's from the New York Times. Wolf Called Romeo has done really, really well. And Nick is in town because he's going to be speaking at Evening at Egan tomorrow night at 7 p.m. And there's more. There's something going on with, like, a Romeo that there's, you're going to tell me about this, about after the show. Tomorrow he's going to speak and he's going to answer questions, and then there'll be books for sale. But there's also something else. You want to tell us what's going on?
Well, a major part of the presentation is, of course, a slideshow and a couple of video clips as well of Romeo. But it's an Evening at Egan event, all right, but at the same time, it's also a benefit to raise money for the Black Wolf Special Project. I've been working for 5 years now, along with a few other people, including the and agencies, including the Forest Service, State of Alaska's cooperated, the Alaska Wildlife Alliance, to having an exhibit of Romeo. Of course, his skin was confiscated by the state, and it seemed like, you know, although I'm not a wonderful fan of taxidermy at this point in my life, still it's the only way we could sort of have something fitting happen to his remains. And been working for a long time to get a museum designer involved, a state-of-the-art wildlife artist, not just your garden variety taxidermist, someone who's going to work with photos and make clay modeling from the skull to produce a wolf that theoretically is going to look like him.
Let's back up. That's fabulous. Sure. Let's back up. Let's start, like, at square zero. Sure. Okay. Let's talk in your words. I'm really curious. So mm-hmm. let's say somebody out there, it's a Juno audience. Many mm-hmm. people knew about Romeo, but let's not assume that everyone knew about the black wolf that was living out by the glacier. I'd like to hear your interpretation of the Romeo story, of how it began and how it ended. And
well, it's hard to sum up. It's something that's totally surreal, even after all this time. It's hard to believe it's 6 years since he was killed. But basically, out of the blue, as if he'd been dropped from outer space, as if he'd been a unicorn, a black wolf showed up out near the glacier and started engaging people's dogs, and had an incredibly, right from the start, very laid-back social demeanor around people and dogs, which is unusual for wolves.
So when you say engage...
He wanted to play with them. He wanted to socialize with them. Basically, it became a surrogate pack for him. And he was a wolf on his own, which is somewhat unusual. Not unusual to see a wolf by itself, but unusual for a wolf to remain by itself for a period of years, especially a big male wolf, which he certainly was. And, of course, there are a number of different theories, which I wrote about in the book, as to how he ended up there. But I think it is safe to say that he got his social fix from dogs and, by extension, people. And over time, absolutely and without a doubt, had social relationships, not only with a number of dogs that he saw as friends, just the same way other dogs do, but with individuals, with humans.
And how long was, you know, from the moment that...
Six years.
He was out there for 6 years.
He was out there for 6 years. And
and do you think people were feeding him?
You know, I never, ever saw evidence of that. I'm sure that he might have snitched some dog food from backyards. And I think there were probably some numbnuts that were setting out food now and then. But in general, I kicked apart and picked apart hundreds of his scats over the years. And I should have done a scientific study and catalog of what I found in it, but he was eating predominantly wild food, lots of bunnies, lots of beavers. He was a small game specialist. Occasionally there'd be deer hair, lots of fish bones. He ate salmon like crazy. And I don't, you know, just in general, he was a wild wolf. He wasn't looking to us for food. He did not act like a food-conditioned wolf. He did not act like an animal who's trying to get something from you. As a matter of fact, I did hear of a couple instances where people had, like, beef jerky or something with them, you know, and they were either weren't expecting to see a wolf or whatever, and he wasn't very interested at all.
He had his own palate.
Yeah, he was living on his own independently, and there were times when he was thinner, and there were times when he was fatter.
Right. And then let's talk about his demise. So he lived out there for 6 years. You know, just even talking about this, I was living out that way, as you were too at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him on such a regular basis, and, you know, I didn't really realize this, but I'm kind of getting choked up. So
Well,
it was a piece of magic in our lives.
It absolutely was. It was a defining moment in Juno's history, really, and one that was extended over time, where the character of this community was tested in, and as far as I'm concerned, came out with flying colors. It was just unbelievable the amount of forbearance and cooperation and tolerance that
to coexist with something that wild.
Right. Including neighbors I had who weren't fond at all of the idea of having a wolf around. But people who could have shot him didn't. The different management agencies that were involved could have taken different paths easily. He could have just disappeared, and they did not. And everybody was just sort of spellbound in this surreal experience, and you know, if it hadn't been for the for the, all the pictures I have, and I you know, it still seems like a surreal experience. It seems like something I must have dreamed. And the as far as the emotional content of the whole thing, it seems like it was just yesterday.
It does. It does. So let's talk about his demise. And it, or actually, let's not.
You know, that's such an unimportant part of the story.
Let's not.
It really isn't. You know, and I'm not, of course, I wrote about it in the book. But, you know, it's easy to cast this into something tragic. But the fact is this wolf lived among us. He almost tripled the life expectancy of your average wild wolf. Think about that. According to very good studies, average wild wolf lives to be about 3. He was already an adult. They don't get to die of old age. You may seem surprised, Joan, but they live a nasty, hard, short existence.
I didn't realize that it was only 3.
Yeah, well, they could live to be 10. They could, you know, like a large dog, 10 to 12,
right,
with occasionally a little older than that. But in general, they just don't. And we're talking about in areas where they're totally protected. So it was a success story. And the fact is this, the two guys who killed him were really outliers. They weren't even from here in a real sense of the word. I mean, the one guy actually lived in Pennsylvania, and the other guy came from Pennsylvania to get away from his rather sordid past there, trailing a pretty questionable history. And the last I heard, he's a guest of the state of Pennsylvania right now again.
Yeah.
It's the kind of guy he was. So, you know, they're a minor part of the story. They're an asterisk. This is a story about the positive things. To me, it is. And the more time goes, the less the killers seem important to me.
And what you said about how we coexisted and how there were so many different roads to take and how the community just was amazing. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Juno Afternoon. Nick Janz is in town. He'll be speaking at Evening at Egan tomorrow at 7 p.m. He is the author of A Wolf Called Romeo and also the author of 11 other published books. He will be speaking tomorrow, and also it's a fundraiser for, can we call it the Romeo Project? Does it have a formal name?
The Black Wolf Special Project. The reason we're keeping it neutral for political reasons, because there's always this back and forth about the naming of animals and everything else.
I was just about to say that I'd rather it be the Black Wolf too, because Romeo is like he was some kind of pet.
How the name came about was...
I don't even know.
Well, it was my wife, actually.
All roads lead to Nick Jazz.
Well, I would not say so at all. But this particular instance, I mean, Sherry is cleaned half of Juno's teeth in those days. And, of course, we lived out there, and the wolf was out there constantly waiting for our yellow lab, Dakota, who was on the cover of the book. And Sherry looked out of the window one morning, and with her arms crossed in this best mom voice, said, "Well, there's that Romeo wolf again." Like, you know, the no good that your daughter's going around with.
Obviously, it was a female lab. Okay.
And the thing is, you know, we saw the wolf, the wolf, the wolf, the wolf. I have a whole chapter dealing with the naming of animals in general, and some wildlife managers consider that to be just a total anathema, only a bad thing. But the fact is, other wildlife agencies totally name animals. You go to Annan Creek, every bear has a human name.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Brooks Falls, every bear there has a name. And
they're not like 212/C or
no.
Something like that.
And the thing is that if this had been the Black Wolf had been 212/C, do you think anything would have been different? Really? I don't see how the story would have been different. I don't think anyone personalized that wolf any more than he personalized himself. He was a totally unique animal. He was, you know, sort of like John Coffey in, the Green Mile. He was a miracle of God. He was something else. He was something different. There was no doubt about that.
He was. And I think that's a good place to stop.
Sure.
So, once again, Nick Jans is in town. He'll be speaking evening at Egan tomorrow at 7 about his book, A Wolf Calls Romeo.
Slideshow. Lots of
interactive
pictures.
Questions and answers. He's got...
I'll be selling books and photos after. And P.S., I'm not set up to take credit cards.
So bring cash. There
yeah, and
go.
The profits will all go toward the Black Wolf Special Fund.
Well, thank you for doing that. And thank you for joining us. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. It's 30 minutes past the hour.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday, the 15th of October, 2015. It's the birthday of the poet Virgil, born near Mantua, Italy, in 70 B.C., who set about to write his epic poem, The Aeneid. He'd been working on it for 11 years, went to Greece, caught a fever, and died before he could finish. He asked that the incomplete poem be burned, but the Emperor Augustus ordered it preserved, and it became the basis of standard curriculum in Roman schools. It's the birthday of a great radio announcer, Bob Trout, the newscaster, born in Wake County, North Carolina, 1909, wanted to be a writer someday like his hero Jack London, worked at various odd jobs, winding up at a radio station, WJSV, which was bought by CBS, and then Robert Trout moved to New York, joined Edward R. Murrow in the CBS newsroom. He became famous for his ability to improvise during major news events. He got the nickname the Iron Man. During the Allied invasion of Normandy, he began broadcasting at 3 in the morning, didn't stop for more than 7 hours. It was Robert Trout who announced the official end of World War II to Americans. And when in April 1945 he got the news of Franklin D. Roosevelt's death, he interrupted a broadcast and delivered an impromptu 25-minute tribute to Roosevelt without any notes and any advance work. He was a formal radio announcer, dressed in tailored three-piece suits, wore a hat out of doors, and tipped it whenever he passed a woman. And it's the birthday of Italo Calvino, born in Santiago de Las Vegas, Cuba, 1923, to Italian parents. Joined the Italian resistance during World War II, afterward moved to Turin, and found a community of novelists and tried to write realistic novels, politically committed novels, and then decided rather than trying to write the book he thought he ought to write, he would write the book, the sort of book that he himself would want to read. And those were novels that combined fantasy and reality, including The Baron in the Trees and If on a Winter's Night a Traveler. Here's a poem for today by Joy Sutphen, On the Shortest Days. At almost 4 in the afternoon, the wind picks up and sifts through the golden woods, the tree trunks bronze and redden, branches on fire in the heavy sky that flickers with the disappearing sun. I wonder what I owe the fading day, why I keep my place at this dark desk by the window, measuring the force of the wind, gauging how long a certain cloud will hold that pink edge that even now has slipped into gray. Quickly the lights are appearing, a lamp in every window, and nest of stars on the rooftops, ladders lean against the hills, and people climb, rung by rung, into the night. A poem by Joy Sutphen, On the Shortest Days, from Modern Love and Other Myths, published by Red Dragonfly Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by TIAA Cref, a global financial company dedicated to delivering financial outcomes that matter. TIAA Cref, created to serve, built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Mondays are back at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center. Now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays noon until 6 p.m. Fall schedules are now available online at juno.org/park/diamond park. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
Hello and welcome back to Juno Afternoon. It's 25 minutes to the hour. It is 47 degrees downtown and at the airport and 45 in Mendenhall Valley. Jeff Brown is the producer and engineer of the show. He's at the board. I'm Joan Pardis. You're Talking Head for Thursdays. And our next guests are Carrie Natwick from Bartlett Regional Hospital and Ruth Johnson from Cancer Connection. And they're here to talk about this Saturday's Cancer Connections Health Forum. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's talk at the very basic of the who, what, where, when, and why. So it's this Saturday where?
This Saturday at Centennial Hall, and it is a collaborative event this year hosted by Bartlett Regional Hospital, Cancer Connection, and Southeast Radiation Oncology. It's doors open at 9:30, and it's a pretty much an all-day event till 2 o'clock with exhibitors, many local exhibitors from the cross-section of the healthcare community in Juneau. And we have some concurrent breakout sessions in the morning from 9:30 to 10:30, and again from 10:45 to 11:45, keynote and lunch at noon.
Okay. And the focus is around?
The title of the health forum is Stress Less, Mindfulness and Cancer Prevention.
Okay. All right. And so is this for people who are experiencing cancer or have experienced cancer? Is it for everyone?
This is for everyone. You know, Cancer Connection, our focus is cancer and supporting cancer, people dealing with the disease, people who have survived cancer. But the health forum and this topic can really speak to any disease. The keynote speaker will be talking about your body's, how it manages stress and its relationship to disease, and why managing stress helps prevent disease, not just cancer, but really all disease.
Interesting. So, Carrie, mm-hmm. it's yeah. just really interesting because you think about mm-hmm. the amount of cancer in today's society. And, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm certainly no scientist, but I'm just wondering if there's a direct correlation between the stress that everybody's under and the disease that we're fighting. So just a rhetorical question out there.
Yeah.
So, Carrie, from Bartlett Regional Hospital, you're going to be one of the presenters. What is the topic that you're going to be talking about?
So I'm going to be one of the first presenters at 9:30 on Saturday. And the title of my presentation is Fighting Cancer with Your Fork. And it's nutrition and cancer prevention. And so in a nutshell, what I'll be talking about is this powerful act of eating that we all do three times per day. And in the act of eating, we're actually communicating with our DNA, with our genes. And that's where, that's the impetus of cancer. That's where that cell division, whether or not we're eating a diet that turns on tumor suppressor genes or we're eating a diet that proliferates cancer cells, can have a huge impact on whether or not we develop cancer or whether we remain cancer-free. As many people know, there's a very strong link and correlation between nutrition and cancer. And so I'll be kind of outlining a lot of bullet points and a lot of tips, and there's going to be a lot of information about what people can do with their diet to prevent cancer.
Wow, that sounds really powerful.
Yeah, it is.
And that's one of the four breakout
right.
sessions. So let's talk about the three other, and because that sounds really powerful, so I suspect all the others are going to be as powerful.
They sure are, yeah.
So also during Carrie's presentation, Dr. Eugene Wong, the radiation oncologist at our own local radiation center here in Juneau, will be speaking on new advances in cancer treatment. Then there will be a short break at 10:30. And at 10:45, Maggie Miller is a genetic counselor coming down from Providence Center in Providence Cancer Center in Anchorage. And her talk is titled, It's in the Genes, Genetics and Cancer. And she's been in Juneau before. She was a very well-received speaker, has a good message. Some surprises, actually, not what you might think about genetics and cancer. And Colleen Torrance is a local counselor. Since our topic was stress, we wanted to bring somebody in to talk about not just the nutrition aspect of managing your cancer prevention, but, you know, some mental health exercises. And the title of her talk is Harnessing the Power of the Mind for Cancer Intervention.
Okay, and then there's the lunch, and then there's a keynote during the lunch as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, so lunch is served at noon, and the lunch that we are serving is very intentional. It models what the ideal diet basically looks like in terms of cancer prevention. So the lunch was designed by myself and then one of our local dietitians, Linda Wild, and it's a plant-based diet or a plant-based meal that's going to focus going to highlight, I guess, lentils and brown rice and lots of vegetables. And then we are also going to have a delectable dessert that features beets and chocolate. And that's all I'm going to tell you. So you'll have to come down and check it out for yourself.
It sounds great. And then what is the keynote topic?
Dr. Pujari has also been here before. She's definitely a backed by popular demand speaker. She's a very interesting healthcare provider. She's a classically trained, I think her medical degree came from Tufts. She's an internist. She also went on to specialize in herbology and has advanced degrees in holistic medicine. And she now has an integrative practice in Seattle in the Fremont District. But she will be talking about, and her last topic actually was on nutrition and cancer prevention, the relationship between nutrition and cancer. But this time she will be talking mostly about stress and its relationship to disease prevention, specifically cancer.
Okay. So this is all happening this Saturday at Centennial Hall. It starts at 9:30, lunch is included, and it's a free event. Is that correct?
Yes.
And it's in its 15th year, and typically how many people have come to this in the past? I know it's kind of one of the institutional events here.
It is. Well, we are ready for the masses, and we expect somewhere around 350 people to show up. Yeah.
That's
so,
fantastic.
Yep, and everyone is welcome.
Okay. Well, and if people need more information, where Cancer Connection, they should search Cancer Connection. It's all on the website.
CancerConnectionAK.org.
Okay, great. Well, ladies, thank you so much for what you do for our community. It is appreciated. And thanks for coming in. And we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with Grace Elliott.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Need some adventure this November? Join us as we explore life on the boundary. Sick of Whale Fest will take you on a journey from the history of deep sea exploration to navigating the changing shorelines and finally plunging under the ice to reveal unique life that exists. Come to Sitka to celebrate marine life with our science talks, wildlife cruises, market food, music, art, and more. Sitka Whale Fest, November 5th through the 8th. For more information and tickets, go to sickawhalefest.org.
The debate about immigration is divisive and controversial. It's easy to forget that there are real people behind the numbers and the name-calling.
They are people. They are human beings. They are not animals. They are not criminals.
I'm Daniel Hernandez. Join me to hear the human stories behind the hype on Immigration Uncovered from Round Earth Media.
Tonight at 7 o'clock on KTOO News Juneau.
Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. It is almost 15 minutes to the hour. You're listening to KTOO. Grace Elliott is here. She is here to chat about the Community of Compassion's meeting last night. And we were just chatting about it, but Grace, can you tell me what it is and what happened last night?
I am delighted to be here to tell you what it is and what happened last night. I'm back so soon. Yesterday, I came on the program briefly just to announce this meeting that we've called Community of Compassion, and the idea was originally conceived in response to yet another death of heroin overdose. And from the time that I first thought, wow, this community needs to come together and have a place to speak about not only deaths from heroin overdose, but suicide and some of the other problems related to chronic mental illness, depression. There's so much going on in our community that puts people at risk for these things. And I'm watching my children's generation die. I'm watching a generation disappear. That was my original thought. So And I also know a great deal more about the reality of drug use and problems among people like in their 20s particularly than I think a lot of the community at large knows. And what I wanted to do was start to invite people who feel profoundly affected by this, and just started literally going one person to the next, taking a person by the hand and saying, do you know what's going on out there? Or saying, I know you're struggling with this, let's get together. So it was really a grassroots kind of effort, and so last night was our very first meeting together.
Let me ask you just a few questions.
Sure.
You said, do you know what's going on here? Let's paint a picture here. So here in Juneau, how many deaths?
6 this year.
Yeah, and like in just...
And that's just, those are just heroin overdoses. That doesn't count the suicides among young people. There, in this last year, there are 2 people, young people that I know, that I know personally, that were friends or friends of my children, their parents are my friends. And I'm sure there are many more that I don't know about. I don't know about them for a couple of reasons. The largest reason is there's such a stigma attached to it, and families understandably are very self-protective, because there's a lot of judgment around addiction, around suicide, or there's a stigma attached to it, and people have a hard enough time coping with that reality, and they don't need anything further taxing them. So it flies under the radar, and that's the problem with most of this. I was just talking to Nick, who you just interviewed here, about exactly the problem and what it was like when we each grew up in big urban areas in the 70s, and what like heroin use was at that time, and where you sort of knew what population it affected, and it was small and it was contained. And unfortunately, a lot of people in our community still have that notion of heroin or drug use in general here, and that is a completely outdated notion. Folks, it is everybody. And what this meeting demonstrated last night was that it could happen to anybody. But what also was demonstrated last night was that there is such a need for connection and such a will to empowered action. It was so beautiful. On that sunny night that we had last night, a Wednesday night, we had 65 people come out.
Yeah, that is... But there's obvious, you know,
impressive.
Yeah, beyond impressive. It's very impressive, and thank you for doing that and creating a space for that. But this has to be addressed. I mean, what can people do? This is tragic.
First we meet. This is in my mind. I had meet, greet, eat, talk. That's pretty much what we did. And I, my beloved friend Pat McClear, when I first told her about this idea, like, Pat, what are we going to do? We have to reach out and make a space for people where they can come and feel safe and talk about what's really going on. Let those of us who know what's going on about there out there come and talk about it. And she said, I'll cook. And so, you know, being of Irish lineage, this is part of what we do. We come together and we feed each other. And I felt that people just need the human connection. We need to connect to each other at a heart level, and that cannot be forced. The only way to do that is to be in a space with a person long enough to relax. Food helps do that. Conversation helps do that. So that's what we did. We brought food, and we invited people in and asked them to put a name tag on and put up big posters that people could write on that said, what's the heart of the matter or the heart of the problem? And what does our community need? And what's your biggest, most beautiful, wildest dream for Juneau? And let people express themselves that way. So people had something to eat, and they introduced themselves to people they hadn't met before. And people would go up and write an idea on one of these posters, and someone else would read it. And then suddenly there was a way to communicate with that person you'd never met before. And after doing that for about an hour, we all sat down in a giant circle down there. We used up most of the chairs in the television studio here. It took place in the 360 North studio, which is the K2 TV station studio. And we just did a talking circle, and we went around that circle, and the most remarkable things happened. There were 6 parents there who had lost children to overdose or other things. Brenner Hafner died September 4th here in Juneau. His entire family came. And there were recovering addicts. Some people had many years in. Some people were brand new in recovery. Everyone showed up as a community member, not their role in the community, just as a neighbor and a friend, including our police chief, who I am feeling very encouraged about the Juneau Police Department. I'm happy to say that I've lived here 35 years. That's the first time I've ever said it. And one mother spoke about her daughter's active addiction and that the daughter is a prostitute in order to support her habit. People have no idea how common that is in Juneau. That is very common in Juneau. There were remarkable stories that came out, and the most beautiful thing about it was that everyone held the space for every other person there, and everyone felt safe to speak there what was on their heart and what was on their minds. And so it's obvious we need to do this again. We are going to do it again here at 360 North on November 15th at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So for now, I think we're going to keep the same format. I know out of this will come inspired action and empowered action, but it's also clear that we have a real need just to meet. And there should be an article coming out this Sunday in the Empire that covers a lot of this story that will have more of the details, but definitely November 15th at 3 o'clock here will be the next meeting like this.
Okay. So. And do you have, is there any way that people could get more information? Is there a contact number or is there any web presence in any way, shape, or form?
I'm putting that together right now, and just because I had a little bit of an issue with the Facebook page that I'm putting up, I'm not going to announce it today, but I should have that worked out by Sunday. So hopefully that'll be in the paper. That information will be in the paper. I did talk to the reporter there and asked her, if I can update her with that information. So look in Sunday's paper, and we'll have much more of a presence, in social media from here on out. Initially, that wasn't the way to do it. It's just to connect one person to the other. Now there's enough people. Everybody at the end of that meeting held hands and made the commitment to go out and take one other person by the hand. And so that's what I'm asking anybody that's listening today. Please just grab someone's hand and just ask them how they're doing. Just ask them how they're doing. This isn't just about heroin or suicide. There's pervasive mental illness out there. We live in a climate at a latitude where there are many environmental pressures on us. There's a lot of depression. There's PTSD. There's a lot of things that we don't know about. We know intuitively this time of year can be hard. So please just grab one other person by the hand and let them know that there's a lot of friends and neighbors out there to support them.
Yeah, but who care? Mm-hmm. So if you're just joining us, that's Grace Elliott. Grace Elliott's here. She's talking about the Community of Compassion meeting that took place last night. And there will be another one November 15th, an article in the Juneau Empire this Sunday with some more information about how you could participate and perhaps help. So Grace, thank you so much for making that happen and everyone else and all the people who cooked and all the people who came. It's important.
Yeah.
So we're going to take a short break. It's almost 7 minutes to the hour, and we'll be right back with Nancy DeCherney. Okay, thanks. Hello, you're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. It is 6 minutes to the hour, and Nancy DeCherney is here to do a very abbreviated
part. We're going to speed through this.
Speak very quick.
Okay, so let's see. Friday night, we've got a night on Bourbon Street, the Chamber of Commerce annual dinner. We have Come to the Cabaret at the Jack with this Barney McClure group, Kari Griffin and the Wrist Rockets, and there's Evening at Egan. So you have many things to do Friday night. On Saturday, there's a second annual garlic lovers potluck at the which the Garden Club is doing at the Canvas. Just bring some garlic stuff and join in. That's from 4:30 to 7. There's a spaghetti feed to benefit the Special Olympics at Thunder Mountain High School at 4:30. Wooshkina Day's Poetry Grand Slam. It's got a big lineup. 6 o'clock to 9:30 over at the Jack. Come and do that. The Student Symphony have two performances, 8 o'clock at Glacier Valley, and then on Sunday at 3 p.m. at the Jack. We've got, let's see, a pancake breakfast on Monday because it's a holiday.
It's Alaska Day,
and all Alaskans like pancakes. So that's where the senior center is to benefit.
I don't know.
I'm not making them.
They should be. They're at the senior center.
Yes, they should be. Yeah, it's a benefit for that, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. And there's also from 2 to 3, they're going to be drawing the winner of the raffle that's to benefit the Seward statue. So that's over at the Jack. Let's see. I think we might have made it through all the really high important things here. We can go back and hit something. I don't know. Traveler Duo is tonight Friday night from 6 to 9 p.m. at Rockwell.
Okay, and then you said something about Kari Groven.
And the Wrist Rockets are at McGivney's at 10 on Friday night. So there's quite a few little pieces of music stuff to do out there. Symphonies and Barney McClure and poetry and all kinds of things. So if you
need Chan's at UAS.
Yes, at Evening in Egan. The
Cancer Connection Health Forum on Saturday.
Oh my gosh, see how it is? And there's a DZ to DC fundraiser garage and bake sale at 8 in the morning at the DZ Middle Commons. I think the band, the jazz band.
What day
band,
is that?
Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we'll just do this randomly, and then you can go on to the website, jahc.org, and just get the details.
Okay, before I let you go, what is the big next thing that's happening?
The next, you know, we are having a twig furniture making contest, or not a contest, but a workshop. Harvey Van Patten from Gus Davis is coming over on the first week of November, and he's offering a twig workshop. I've heard great things about it. If you're interested, please sign up. If we don't have 10 people, he's not going to do it. So give us a call if you're interested in that. That's that. And then there's First Friday coming up. We'll talk about that. And then we have Letters Aloud.
Okay, and the number to call if you want to talk about
586 Arts.
Okay, great. Nancy, thank you so much for coming. We are going to go right into the weather here. So tonight, rain likely in the evening, then slight chance of rain late, patchy fog late, except areas of fog late near Juneau Airport. Lows around 40. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, patchy fog in the morning, except areas of fog in the morning near Juneau Airport. Friday night, rain, lows around 47. Saturday, rain, highs around 54. And Saturday night, rain, lows around 45. Currently, it is 40 at the airport, 42 downtown Juneau, 39 in the Mendenhall Valley, and that's going to drop it's going to warm up. We're going to get some rain, I guess. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us on Juno Afternoon. You could listen anytime at ktoo.org. And have yourself a great day. Jeff Brown's the producer and engineer of the show, and I'm Joan Pardis. Next up, All Things Considered.